You dying there, Candace?
You know, I'm not dying. It's just, I think like the baby is somehow like sitting on my, I don't even know what it is, but it sounds like I'm losing my voice. And my voice sounded like this for like a month now. I'm not actually losing my voice. I just have a new voice. It's like the weirdest thing.
Is your baby just like grabbing your vocal cord somehow from down there? I don't know.
Seriously, this hasn't happened with any of my other pregnancies. So I don't have any explanation, but I just have like a raspy sounding voice now. I sound like one of those like, I don't know, like I'm like a smoker or like one of those like soothing like yoga, you know, like yoga podcasts or like meditation podcasts.
I must say I'm not actually very familiar with the dulcet tones of the yoga meditation podcasters.
This is new.
Harrison,
to me
are you?
Well. Is that no, your, I was going to say this is new to me as well. Never heard. Never heard of that happening. And also, no, I haven't listened to any of the yoga instructors' soothing voices.
They're always so calm and so like subdued and maybe a little raspy. I don't know.
It's amazing how like there is a type of voice in different media, like NPR voice. There's like a very distinctive public broadcaster voice that's different than other broadcaster voices.
Well, Andrew, you have like the best talk radio voice. Like your voice was like, I don't know if you like made your voice to sound that way or if you were like 15 years old and you just like sounded like a radio announcer in the playground. But
yeah,
like,
it gives me like sports announcer vibes. That's funny because you know very little about sports, Andrew.
I know. I was always so jealous. There was a guy I worked with when I was in radio who had like just a perfect one. And it was not fake, but it was just that really deep baritone. Everything he said sounded like he was calling a sports game, and I was always so jealous. So you're very kind.
No, I think you have the perfect radio voice. So you picked the right profession, Andrew. Okay, guys, let's get this started. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning into the podcast. This is Off the Record. I always introduce my guests, which is Andrew Lawton, host of The Andrew Lawton Show, and Harrison Faulkner, host of Ratioed. I don't know that I always introduce myself. So I'm Candace Malcolm. I'm the founder of True North, and I'm the host of The Candace Malcolm Show as well. And we were just talking about how my voice is raspy and I'm kind of losing it. So forgive me if I have to take breaks to drink water or just try to sit upright. You can't see obviously from this angle, but I'm pretty heavily pregnant over here. And I think it must somehow be related because my voice has just changed. But anyways, we've got a great show for you today. If you are new around here, don't forget to subscribe to the True North channel. Like this video. If you're listening to the podcast and you enjoy it, please leave us a 5-star review. Finally, don't forget to head on over to our website, tnc.news, so you can sign up for our newsletter. You never miss an episode, never miss a story. So I guess before we get into it all, I just want to wish you both a happy March break season. That's what we heard over and over again over the weekend, last weekend. And also apparently happy Transgender Day of Visibility because it wasn't just Easter. This is a weird thing. And Andrew, I know we've talked about before about how there's like a war on Christmas and no one wants to say Merry Christmas anymore. But I didn't remember it spilling into Easter. I was kind of surprised by how many times I heard people say happy holidays to me over Easter or happy, we saw it a lot on social media, happy March break or happy March holiday season. Is this a new thing or has this always been the case? I don't know.
I think it's new. I mean, Easter always bounces around a bit. Sometimes it's a bit earlier, other times it's a bit later. So maybe just when Easter falls in March, it just gets consumed by this so-called March holiday season. But no, you're right. I did notice a lot more of the genericization of the, well, first off, I've never heard of an Easter season before. It's always just Easter. There's Good Friday, there's Easter Sunday, and then there's kind of Easter Monday, which is not really a real thing, but that's it. Like the Christmas season is a thing, and that's sort of why that becomes consumed by the broader holidays. But yeah, the Easter season I've never heard of until this year.
Well, do you know what? It's almost like they're trying to make the holiday less religious, but they make it more because, of course, it is Holy Week, right? It starts, well, it starts with Lent and it starts with Ash Wednesday.
Yeah, it should be a season, but it never has.
It is. You know, it's a whole week. It's Palm Sunday, and then it goes on throughout the week. So it made it feel more religious to me when people kept saying Happy Easter season. But obviously, Easter is a very important day for Christians, and it's a very solemn, sort of important holiday. And so it just felt like a real slap in the face when we had Joe Biden, the president of the U.S., coming out and declaring Easter to be Trans Day of Visibility. I think this is one of those examples where the left is just so incredibly out of touch. They don't recognize how bad of an issue this is and how much just regular people disagree with it. Like, you know, again, like bumping into parents at my kid's school, or, you know, dad's like on the playground, and everyone was making fun of this. Everyone was joking about it, about how tone deaf it was and ridiculous it was for the president to call Easter Transgender Day. It's like combining the two worst aspects, which is like canceling the foundations of our civilization, Christianity, and pushing this trans agenda down our throats. Harrison, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I found it to be intentionally provocative. I mean, I think that the reality is, like, we can pretend as though it was just a coincidence and they didn't really think about how this would impact Christians and how this would come across. Or we can really just kind of cut to the chase and be honest here. These are not idiots who are running the White House. And this is also done by Justin Trudeau. He also made a Transgender Day of Visibility post on Easter. Both supposedly Catholics who made these proclamations on Easter. And again, I don't think that this is just a coincidence. When it falls on Easter, you can maybe forget about Transgender Day of Visibility. But instead, they double down. They have to be provocative. They have to trigger this response out of Christians. And of course, it is an attack on Christianity to do this. You are conflating Easter, the most important day in the Christian calendar, with something that goes completely contrary to Christian values and Christian beliefs. Again, Canada in particular is a Christian country. That's just not a really debatable fact. The head of our country is also the head of the Church of England. So it is a Christian country. And for the Prime Minister to do this, and for the President to do this in the United States, I think it's intentionally provocative and designed to get a response out of people.
Yeah, it's interesting just even how things have changed. Because I remember a few years ago, Trudeau put out a pretty religious statement on Easter, talking about what Christians believe. Not necessarily his faith, but just putting it forward, because the reality is Canada is a very diverse country and the politicians sort of recognize and acknowledge religious holidays for all religions. So we see, you know, we hear the Prime Minister talk about, you know, the importance of Eid or Ramadan, talk about Jewish holidays, Indian holidays, like all Hindu holidays. I mean, you know, all kinds of holidays. And at one point he would acknowledge Christians in that mix. And now it doesn't seem like he did. I didn't see anything about Easter from our Prime Minister, but we did see a lot of sort of wokeism taking over here in Canada. So a church in Calgary, I mean, I don't know if you can really consider Unitarian churches to be churches, they decided to just, you know, combine Easter church service with a creepy, cringy groomer drag show. So that's interesting. That happened. And we also had Calgary Mayor Jody Gondek tweet about, I don't know, something about Transgender Day of Visibility and how horrible Daniel Smith is implied in that, in the body of the tweet there. But really, you know, just again, kind of rubbing it in our face and trying to make Easter, like, look, you can talk about trans other days, right? It's like Christians have this like one weekend where it is a very important, very solemn holiday. And it seems like they're really going out of their way to ram this down our throat. Andrew, what's your thought?
Well, so I actually disagree with some of this, because like with what you guys have said, just because March 31st is the day of International Transgender Day of Visibility, and it has been every year. Joe Biden has proclaimed it every year. Easter bounces around. If they fall on the same day, then you're not really, if you're going to observe both, in a position where you can pick and choose when to do it. I think the bigger question is, why is this day itself attracting so much of this proclaiming in the first place? Because look, if you've decided that you're going to do this, then yeah, if it's March 31st, you make your proclamation that day. I think the bigger issue is that we've seen, like we talked about this last summer at True North, Pride Day used to be a day, and then it was Pride Week, and then it was Pride Month, and then the Canadian government last year was observing Pride season, which started in June and went all the way, or so I think it started in May actually, and went all the way to September. So we had basically 3-4 months of Pride festivities. And then you also have outside of that individual days like Transgender Day of Visibility. And there are other days. There was like a there was some asexual awareness day that I learned of recently that are also scattered throughout the year. And I think in general, there is just this oversaturation of observance days in the same way that there is an oversaturation of colored ribbons and of all of these different campaigns. And I think that it ends up becoming this battle of performative recognition and declarations, which are inevitably going to lead to these sorts of things. So I don't really care about the day so much because that is just an unfortunate accident of timing. But I do have an issue with this need to perform and virtue signal on every single one of these days that's been declared by someone on Twitter at some point.
Well, so someone was passing this around at one point. It ended up in my Twitter feed, but someone had taken all of the holidays that they had created in British Columbia and put it in a calendar, and it was like the most insane thing. It was like every single day was like lesbian day of like remembrance, or I mean it was nonstop. It was just like every single day was something. Half of them were to do with hating Canada, half of them were to do with celebrating other countries that weren't Canada, and then of course recently there was a vote to name, I think it was November, Christian Heritage Month in Canada, and that got defeated. We're not willing to celebrate the actual heritage and history of our own country, but we're willing to celebrate absolutely every other thing, which I think you make a really good point. Andrew Harrison, any more thoughts on this?
Well, yes, I would just say that if, for example, Transgender Day of Visibility fell on the same day as Eid or any other, for example, Muslim holiday, or
it does. We're in the middle of Ramadan.
Ramadan, right? So again, if this were on the most important day, if it was a one day thing and it happened on the exact same day as a Muslim holiday, I don't think that you would see all of these proclamations. I genuinely don't. I think that this is an idea that is taking place in all of these Western countries, that Christian holidays, the most important holiday, can be watered down. It can be described as March, you know, holiday season. It can be described as whatever you want it to be described as. But to give Christians a day that you know, can just be unobstructed by all of this woke virtue signaling is just not going to happen in this country. I don't think that it would happen. And I think that we've allowed it to happen, and that's a big problem.
Andrew, maybe you'll remember this. Didn't Justin Trudeau have a pair of socks that were like both like Muslim moons and also rainbows, like gay pride rainbow socks? And it was like the biggest case of like cognitive dissonance. It's like, does he understand that these two symbols just don't really go hand in hand? But he was like showing them off at one point. I think I remember something.
I think it was that he wore Ramadan socks during pride socks during Ramadan, or if they were like pride Ramadan socks. But I remember that story. Yeah, one of the many socks in the Trudeau sock collection. Yeah,
those were back in the early days of the Trudeau government. But to me, it was really,
and they were
just
halal socks. Sean just shared the link in our channel here. Muslim hipster socks that McLean's wrote about. The beginning of the end of McLean's hard-hitting political coverage. There it is. Yeah, he wore, during Pride, socks that said Eid Mubarak on them. So I don't know if Pride overlapped with Ramadan that year, or if he just, you know, was washing his Pride socks, so he put on the Eid Mubarak socks. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I just remember the comments were full of Muslims who very, very wholeheartedly disagreed with this merging of the two trends happening at once. So,
yeah, but to your point, I mean, Harrison, so the Ramadan is underway right now, and Trudeau had said nothing on Good Friday, but had on the Thursday prior posted something about Ramadan. So, like, this is the problem. I mean, I'm kind of at the view that
no video
about anything, and then you can't be criticized for missing stuff.
Yeah, and no video. He didn't make a video for Easter on Sunday. And I found that to be very strange as well, because Trudeau makes videos for every single, you know, Pride Month, every single holiday, but not for Easter, which I found to be very surprising.
Yeah, which why I think it was pretty refreshing when I went onto Twitter over the weekend and I saw there was a post from Pierre Polyev saying he is risen, happy Easter, which is just a sort of very basic part of Easter celebrations, but it seems bold and almost provocative for a politician to actually acknowledge a Christian holiday these days. I think we have a video of what Pierre Polyev posted over the weekend.
He is risen. Today, Christians celebrate the resurrection of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Through his sacrifice, he paid the ultimate price for our sins and overcame the power of death itself so that we could rejoice in his promise of everlasting life. The joy of Easter unites all Canadians. It reminds us that although we face hardship, we have the promise of a new beginning, of redemption, and of the hope of eternal life. As families come together to attend church services, paint Easter eggs, and enjoy some much-needed rest, may you be refreshed and restored in the spirit of Easter season. Happy Easter.
What a nice message, and I personally really appreciated that. It wasn't just Pierre Poilievre. We had Saskatchewan Premier Scott Moe putting out a message just saying, "He is risen. Happy Easter, Saskatchewan." We had New Brunswick Premier Blaine Higgs saying, "May the miracle of Easter renew your faith, strengthen your spirit, fill your heart with gratitude and praise. Marcia and I wish you a joyous and blessed Easter." And Danielle Smith, Premier of Alberta, she wrote on Good Friday, "Good Friday reminds Christians of the selfless sacrifice of Jesus Christ and the boundless love that he demonstrated for humanity. To all Albertans observing the Easter holiday, I hope you may connect with your faith, families, and communities. Have a blessed Good Friday." So like we were saying, you know, politicians do this for every faith and every religion and every group. I don't know if it's pandering, but to me, it seemed like something that I hadn't quite seen before in recent times, which is conservatives in Canada sort of just being like unafraid to post a message that would have been seen as just very normal and very important like 50 years ago. But, you know, in our sort of postmodern, post-national civilization and culture right now, it just seems like it's almost like taboo. So I see this as almost like countercultural. And I was proud that the conservatives were putting out these messages of faith. What's your take on all this, Andrew?
I think you're right. I mean, there certainly is something about how there is a new counterculture. And I do wonder if, certainly in numbers, we see that religion overall is in decline, Christianity is in decline. But when you break down those numbers and you look at where it is growing, it's actually quite noteworthy that this is actually the really traditional denominations and traditional churches that are seeing growth. And I actually think that's incredibly valuable to note. So there does seem to be, even among younger people, a bit of a generational shift where things that even 5 years ago were seen as, oh, that's antiquated, no one does that anymore, are starting to have a bit of a return.
Yeah, I mean, I went to a church service on Sunday. It was a sunlight one, so it was a 6 a.m. service, and then the sun came up just before 7. It was amazing. There were hundreds of people, and, you know, I'm an Anglican, and we usually have a hard time getting more than like 30 or 40 people out to a church service, but there was hundreds of people. Everyone was out, and it was beautiful and amazing to see. So I feel like there is some kind of a resurgence around faith happening in this moment. Harrison, do you see it among sort of younger people in your generation, Gen Zers?
Yeah, I think that more young Canadians, young Christians are looking for churches that aren't going to accept non-Christian values, woke preaching, all of this stuff. And a lot of that I'm seeing from the Catholic Church right now. I'm an Anglican myself. I went to two services. I went to a Good Friday service and an Easter Sunday service, and both were very well attended. It was nice to see. But this is really like we're scraping the bottom of the barrel here. You know, the fact that we're now celebrating conservative politicians and politicians in general who make Easter posts on social media, this should be a given.
Low bar.
Yeah. This should be almost mandatory in Canada, except it's not. And that is something that I think, you know, the idea that we're celebrating this is the problem. It's the fact that for whatever reason, politicians are afraid to proclaim their faith in a Christian country. They're afraid to say what they know to be true. They're afraid to push back against things that run contrary to their faith, right? Like this Transgender Day of Visibility stuff. I mean, this is what the fact that this is standing out is the problem, in my opinion.
You know, that's a good way of picking it. I remember back in the early days of the Ben Shapiro podcast, he used to do like good Trump and bad Trump. I feel like we just did good conservative. It's like good conservative when you can muster up the courage to put out a Christian message on Easter. Now let's move to bad conservative. Andrew, I'll let you take it from here.
Well, speaking of Trump, I should point out Trump, in response to the Biden proclamation, said he would, if he's elected, declare Christian Visibility Day. So that's basically the way things are going there. You're setting me up for something. What are you? Oh, is this the Aaron O'Toole story?
Aaron O'Toole, yeah.
Okay. Sorry, he's so distant in my memory. It takes a little while to recall Aaron of something or other. Aaron O'Toole, he was one of the witnesses before the inquiry into foreign interference, which is a big issue. And I think that there is certainly a lot of evidence that the Conservatives were targeted in 2021 and to some extent in 2019 over or by agents associated with the Chinese regime. And I think there's evidence that in several ridings, this campaign that we saw the Chinese government, the Chinese Communist Party behind, probably cost the Conservatives the seats, didn't cost them the overall election. It would be convenient if that were the case. The election, according to Aaron O'Toole, was lost because of something else.
So what was your understanding then, based on the modeling on election day, of where the Conservatives would end up in terms of seats that day?
Yeah, reliving those last few days of the campaign. We went from winning the seat count a week before the election with a small, modest minority to, on election day, losing the seat count and still winning the popular vote. We saw the vote changing largely on the vaccine and the vaccine mandate issue. But on election night, when we knew we were going to lose, my campaign manager had said, our models and how the vote goes, you should end up with about 127, 128 seats, which will be a historic level for opposition. And when you consider it was a pandemic election, we were largely on the wrong side of public opinion on the vaccine mandate issue, which is, in my view, why the prime minister called the election. That was being briefed to me to say, calm down, you did okay.
So Aaron O'Toole basically says that the vaccine issue was what cost the Conservatives the election, which I believe it was actually COVID that cost the Conservative election, specifically the O'Toole strain, which came about in 2021. Aaron O'Toole, in that last week of the campaign, reversed core policies that were in his platform. I think there was a bit of external influence in the sense that when Jason Kenney implemented a lockdown in Alberta and a vaccine passport in Alberta, I think that really hurt the Conservative argument on COVID. But in general, Aaron O'Toole is revising history in two ways. Number one, he's saying that the Conservatives were opposed to all of this vaccine mandate nonsense, which was only superficially true. And also that that was the thing that cost them the election, which is absolutely, in no uncertain terms, untrue. And it was just made up, probably so Aaron O'Toole can sleep at night for leading such a disastrous campaign.
So when I first saw your tweet, Andrew, I thought that maybe he had had a come to Jesus moment, and he recognized that his terrible COVID statements and policies are what led him to lose the election. And then I watched a video and I realized that it was the opposite. It was like he was digging in his heels as if like that was somehow the reason that they lost.
Aaron O'Toole says he was too critical of vaccine mandates. Just take that in for a second.
I mean, this is one of the infuriating things that happens, like even now talking to like a liberal friend and they try to tell you like, oh, no, everything was fine. Like we just didn't know that school closures were going to be so detrimental to education. And, oh, the vaccine did work. I mean, it got rid of like the Delta strain or whatever. And it's like it's so frustrating because you're like, well, sure. But like, look at all this other stuff. And yeah, to hear him say that makes me think he's just sort of learned nothing. Harrison, what's your thoughts over there?
So I'm just confused here because I pulled up an article from Global News during the election in 2021, and it says here, O'Toole promises to implement a national proof of COVID-19 vaccination system, a national vaccine passport, something that Trudeau didn't even do. He left that up to the provinces. O'Toole wanted to make it a federal program, and he wanted to, as it says here, make sure that 90% of eligible residents were vaccinated against COVID-19, and is pledging to cover the cost of time off for employees to get a shot, free transportation to vaccine clinics, and a national booster shot strategy that would initially target seniors and the immunocompromised. So I'm just confused here what exactly he means by being offside, because he wanted a national vaccine passport, which was not even something that Trudeau was trying to implement. He wanted to make it a national program. I don't know what he's trying to do here, what he's trying to say, but he definitely was not offside on the vaccine issue when it comes to being on the side of Justin Trudeau. He was offside with Canadians, however. We do know that. That's why he ended up getting ousted from the leadership position. But during the election, if he was trying to compare himself to Trudeau, he was right there, if not even ahead of him on the issue.
Well, that's how I saw it. I think that, like, that's why when I first saw Andrew Scheer, I thought maybe he realized that if the Conservatives had taken a strong principal position, like they did at the very beginning, saying we're not going to implement a vaccine passport ever, period, and we don't agree with this, maybe they would have won the election. Maybe Canadians would have had a bit more respect for a party that was willing to stand on its principles. But the fact that we had this mushy, unclear policy, I mean, I'm going to play this clip. This is one of the worst moments in Canadian politics for me. This is like peak uniparty cringe. Basically, they did a PSA, a public service announcement before the debate, where they all agreed. They all agreed. The science is settled. Everybody, go get your booster. Go get your shot. So this was one of the worst, the lows of the lows of this election. Let's play that clip.
We're all in this together.
We've come so far in the fight against COVID. It's time to finish this pandemic for good. So get vaccinated. If you know someone who hasn't, talk to them. For our kids, for our communities, for our economy. It's how we get forward together.
Vaccines are safe and effective for use. Vaccines are the best way for you to protect yourself, your family, and your community. So get vaccinated. Let's fight COVID-19 together.
Pour vous protéger vous-même, pour protéger les plus fragiles d'entre nous, pour protéger l'ensemble de la population, le meilleur moyen connu demeure le vaccin. S'il vous plaît, soyez responsables, soyez solidaires, faites-vous vacciner. Merci.
We all agree getting vaccinated is the way forward. We're all in agreement. This is not a partisan issue, so please get vaccinated.
We're united, and it's time to get the shot. Vaccines save lives. They're how we're going to beat COVID, and it's time for everyone to do it. Get the shot.
Get the shot.
No.
All right, on three, Candace and Harrison, we're all in this together. One.
I'm not doing it. I'm not doing.
I had a moment there where I totally forgot who the woman at the end was, and I had like, who is that again? That's the Green Party leader, I believe. But oh my god!
No, I had that because I sat next to her on a flight once, and I was like, I know her. Who is she? And then I was like, oh right, and I couldn't even remember her name. So it's like
anime. So she's Jewish, and she was subjected to some just horrendous anti-Semitism from within the Green Party. And I had actually looked her up a couple of days ago, unrelated to this story, because I was curious what she had said about Israel since October 7th. And unfortunately, she has been silent since she was ousted as Green leader. So she hasn't tweeted in 3 years. So the mystery continues. But anyway, carry on.
When I bumped into her at the airport, it seemed like she was pretty private, not really interested in talking about politics at all. But I mean, come on, that was the worst. Watching Erin O'Toole stand, like, it's often the case that all the other parties agree, that all the left-wing parties agree on a policy, and then the Conservatives are like the ones out there speaking for common sense and saying something different and being brave and having a backbone and saying like, no, we don't want to have like whatever the policy is. And this was like, to me, that's why Erin O'Toole lost, is because he caved and because he was saying the exact same stuff as the other parties, which then you might as well just vote for the Liberals. If you want that, vote for the Liberals. And I think that's why he lost. I want to cover this story, Harrison. You might take an interest in it as well. We're learning a little bit about the Liberal Party and how they allow international students and non-residents and foreigners to participate in their party's nominations. So, Steve Chase, who's a great, fantastic, award-winning journalist over at the Globe and Mail, one of the good ones, he posted this. I asked Liberal Party whether they would change their policy to disallow international students from voting in nomination races. Response from Liberal spokesperson: the Liberal Party of Canada is a grassroots movement. Our party's constitution and bylaws are the result of thousands of registered Liberals debating and voting in national conventions to amend and update these documents over the years. That's how we build the most open and inclusive movement in Canada, and any future amendment would follow that process. Steve Chase also mentioned that in tabled documents, they showed that the Liberal Party National Director is Ishmael to Foreign Interference Inquiry, that signing up international students with the Liberal Party and busing them to voting sites for nomination races is compliant with Liberal Party rules. So, you know, anyone can join the Liberal Party. You don't have to pay anything. You don't even have to be a Canadian. You don't even have to be a permanent resident. Heck, you don't even have to live in Canada. And again, this was all in the context of that foreign interference inquiry that Andrew mentioned, that Erin O'Toole was talking at as well. It just seems pretty shocking to me. This is a state of our democracy where we have a party defending a practice where people that aren't Canadian in any way, shape, or form are allowed to participate in our democracy. Doesn't that just feel like, it feels like we don't really have a democracy anymore. Andrew, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, and also it's important to note that, you know, the Conservative Party, I don't know how it is for the NDP, probably similar because they none of them work, but the Conservatives have paid membership. So if you want to be a member of the Conservative Party of Canada, you have to pay your $15. You can't pay with cash. So it means that there is a bit of a fraud prevention mechanism built in there. The Liberals at some point changed it to free membership. So not only can you sign up international students, but you could sign them up without ever having them pay for it, which means it would be very easy for a bad actor to go in, take a list of names, put them on the list, and do whatever is necessary to get these people out to vote in a nomination. And nominations are already very, very susceptible to fraud and wrongdoing. They're not really overseen by Elections Canada. It's kind of the Wild West for political parties. We've heard stories, especially in Ontario politics, of, you know, people that, you know, have been registered 10, 12, 14 names to an apartment and voting in nominations and leaderships. The Liberals don't seem to care about that. I mean, they see it as a feature and not a bug.
Well, they call it a grassroots movement. So I guess that includes everybody in the world. Harrison, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, it's very post-national state of the Liberal Party to allow this, of course, to allow non-citizens to engage in our democracy. And of course, as Andrew said, the nomination process is oftentimes in our country, well, I don't think you mentioned this part, but oftentimes the nomination process is more difficult than the election itself because we have so many ridings that are guaranteed to go one way or the other.
Yeah.
So for conservative ridings, the nomination race is the hardest part. And for the Liberals, the same is true. And we have evidence that many of the individuals who were named by some of that original global news reporting about Chinese infiltration into our democracy, a lot of those individuals were caught up in these nomination races that were you know, significantly helped by non-citizens, by international students, by Chinese students who are being bussed in, as they say, to in my opinion, interfere with this process. This is supposed to be a Canadian system for Canadians where Canadians choose their leaders and their representatives in Parliament, not for temporary foreign workers, not for international students, not for non-citizens to engage to direct change into how our country is going to go into the future. You know, it is also convenient that this is the same government who has skyrocketed international student visas into this country and basically taken the system and driven it out of control. Now, all of a sudden, those people can engage with the Liberal Party and they can dictate who they want to represent them and actual Canadians into Parliament. It's absurd. But it's very post-national state of Justin Trudeau and the Liberal Party.
Well, and even to defend it like that, saying it's compliant with our policies. I mean, we have a graph here from a report that I did that shows the incredible growth in international students who've been coming to Canada. We're at the point where 900,000, they had to cap it at 900,000 last year. So, you know, this is contributing to all sorts of social problems as well. And even our own prime minister is admitting that this massive spike in immigration that has happened under his watch, under his guidelines, under his policy, is far beyond what Canada has been able to absorb. It's funny, he's starting to sound like a True North host, because that's what we say. It's like, you know, don't necessarily have a problem with immigration, but you have to make sure that you can absorb the population and you can integrate them. And when you're letting in 2.2 million people a year, it's just not working. And it's pretty obvious. So Justin Trudeau is acknowledging that. Andrew, I don't know if that is going to lead to a policy change or just like a shrug your shoulders and don't take any accountability, the Trudeau special.
Yeah, I think it's more likely to be the latter. And we already heard a little bit of this from, I forget his name now, the housing minister who used to be the immigration minister.
Sean Fraser?
Fraser, yeah. I was going to say, I don't know what I was going to say, Sean something. But anyway, they're all interchangeable. He had said something where he basically said the government has no say in temporary foreign workers and temporary residents like international students. That he said, oh, no, we only cap, you know, and have a number for permanent residents. The rest of these, it's all just, you know, basically it's the private sector that figures out how many TFWs we get. And it's universities that figure, like, he had this entirely just ridiculous rationalization for why this is somehow not the government's fault.
Wow, it really makes you wonder who's running this place. The Liberals don't seem to have any sense of accountability. I'm gonna turn this over to you now, Harrison. You wanted to talk about this Ontario teacher story.
Yeah, this is a very, very strange story, and I'm wondering where it all came from. But in short, Ontario school boards have now taken to the courts to sue Meta and TikTok for $4.5 billion for, quote, distracting students. All right, so here's the breakdown. Several Ontario school boards have filed lawsuits against social media giants TikTok and Meta, accusing them of inflicting damage on students' mental health. The suit alleges that the social media apps are interfering with students' ability to learn and that teachers are left dealing with the fallout of those effects. So there are now the claimants here, the school boards, are alleging that social media platforms in question were designed for compulsive use and have rewired the way children think, behave, and learn. And they're seeking $4.5 billion. All right, so I'm just very confused here why the school boards are suing TikTok and Meta, the social media platforms, these big tech companies, with our money, of course, because they're making the lives of teachers more difficult, right? That doesn't make much sense to me, but it seems to me, in fact, that maybe a lawyer is behind this and is managing to make a ton of money off of school boards, again, off of our money, for a lawsuit that isn't going to go anywhere. How exactly these social media companies are making life more difficult for teachers is beside me. It's beyond me. And so apparently with Doug Ford, he calls it nonsense. He said that school board lawsuits launched against Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, and TikTok are nonsense and urged them to instead focus on the kids. So Candace, what do you think about this? You've got young kids who are going to school, in some cases probably in school. Do you think that school boards have any grounds here to sue big tech companies?
Well, I just don't understand. Like, if the schools don't want kids on social media at schools, it's pretty easy. Just ban phones. Like, right. That's up to the schools. I'm often, like, just absolutely blown away that schools allow teenagers to bring their phones to school. And you walk around a hallway and you see kids, like, with their face down on phones. So different than when I was in high school. Like, there's a growing movement, especially in the UK, of schools just saying enough. You cannot have a phone with you at school. Leave it at home. And if we see it at school, we'll confiscate it and you will not get it back. It's not like there are ways to deal with this. I think that there's some truth to the idea that these apps and these phones are addictive and it's not good for kids. It's not good for their mental health. It's not good for socialization. I think that the solution is tougher rules and better parenting and better authority from the schools, as opposed to just what you're saying, trying to go shake down social media companies. It seems to be a theme in Canadian politics these days. But this one's just, I'm at a loss. This is very strange.
Andrew, what do you think?
Yeah, it's strange is the best way of putting it, isn't it? Like, it's really difficult to discern what motivations are on stuff like this.
Yeah, I don't understand this. As you said, Candace, they could easily just ban phones. I know the Ontario government even floated that idea not too long ago to try to get phones out of schools and out of classrooms. Yeah. But again, this is an opportunity for school boards to use our money to go after big tech companies. Are they going to win? I doubt it. But no. Someone is going to make a lot of money out of this. And someone had the idea to do this. Yeah. And I think that might be a real motivation here. Someone wants to make a bunch of money off these school boards by going after big tech companies.
Well, and Bay Street lawyers are the real winners in this.
The real villains. It also sort of shows the mindset of the school board that rather than like looking inward and trying to reflect on your own policies and how you can, encourage kids to just get off their phones, talk to parents about it, like, do your own kind of like education campaign about the harms of social media, they just try to, get a headline and go for a huge number, $4.5 billion. Like, is that going to go to the individual children? I doubt it. It's going to go to the school boards. So this just seems like, a very misguided attempt to fix a problem that's real. And I do encourage parents to limit their children's screen time, not allow them to go onto social media, not allow them to enter into that world. We've seen so much about how the sort of slippery slope behind a young 12, 13-year-old girl going on TikTok and all of a sudden she believes she's transgender or she hates mm-hmm. she hates Canada and she believes that Canada's like a genocidal state. Like there's so much nastiness out there. You have to protect your children from it. And there is no way There is no way, Mike. Actually, I was talking to some of the parents at my kid's school about this because you can buy these things that are called dumb phones and they look like smartphones, but they're dumb phones and all they can do is just call mom and dad, right? So like the kid doesn't feel embarrassed or left out when like all their friends have like these cool Android and iPhones. They can pull out a phone that kind of looks like that and they can play around on it, but it doesn't actually allow them to like access the internet or any of like the horrible things that you can find on there.
And also one more thing, how many teachers use TikTok themselves? Don't we see all these videos of these teachers making all these very strange LGBT transgender TikToks going around? We see them on Twitter all the time. So surely there's got to be quite a few teachers themselves who are using these social media apps. Maybe that's making their teaching job a little more difficult as well. I find that to be very strange. Someone should address that.
Yeah, I forgot to make this joke during our last segment, but you know, the person doing the most to promote transgender visibility and awareness is the account Libs of TikTok, which literally just takes, you know, deranged sort of teachers or people who are transgender talking about crazy things and promoting them so that everyone can see the kinds of things they're saying. And so often, Harrison, to your point, they're teachers. Sometimes they're even Ontario teachers that are on there talking about their indoctrination programs and all the plans that they have to turn everybody into, an ally or being transgender themselves. So I think you're right. They could show some better leadership there. Okay, Andrew, I'll pass it over to you. You are going to wrap up this episode with an interesting story that you came across.
This is a weird one. So I kind of love when politicians and political leaders decide to bluff call. It's like in the U.S. when all of those red state governors just started shipping migrants up to like sanctuary cities in Massachusetts saying, okay, here you go, you deal with it. So Germany has, for whatever reason, decided to crack down on trophy hunting. Now, there isn't this wide proliferation of trophy hunting in Dresden or something. They're talking about Germans that go abroad, trophy hunt, and then import their trophies. And in Canada, they're actually quite a few restrictions on this as well. You can't just bring back your rhinoceros horn or something like that. So Germany has done this. Now, there are some countries where trophy hunting, there are some places where trophy hunting is very predatory. It's very icky to a lot of people. There are other places where trophy hunting is a part of the economy. And it's a way that wealthy tourists come in, spend a lot of money, and kill animals that there are too many of. And elephants, African elephants, which are an endangered species, are actually not endangered in Botswana, which has had so much success in its conservation efforts that Botswana is kind of overrun by elephants. So they can sustain this trophy hunting industry there. So Botswana has said to Germany, all right, well, why don't we just send you 20,000 elephants? Now, I don't know the logistics of shipping 20,000 elephants. I mean, when I want to send like a letter to someone, I'm amazed at, oh, well, you actually have to pay for priority airmail and it's going to cost you $50. So 20,000 elephants from Botswana to Germany, probably a little costly there. But Botswana is saying to Germany, well, if you don't want to take in our trophies, how about you just deal with the elephants yourselves? I love it.
Harrison, I know you had some thoughts.
As everyone just says, all right, well, there's nothing more to say on this.
Andrew, you said it all.
Well, I'm in agreement. They should, you know, enrich the German and the German landscape with some Botswana imported elephants. That would really shake things up in the forests over there. But again, no, I think that, again, we had this conversation at the beginning of the show. I think it didn't make it into the, don't think it made it into the video, but it was basically about how a lot of these African countries and these rural villages in Africa want Westerners to come in and trophy hunt and to clear out animals that are causing problems to not only their community, but also to the rest of the wildlife in that area. They see it as a win-win. They're getting rid of animals that are you know, causing significant problems. And of course, oftentimes with these communities, when you kill these trophy animals, the food goes to the village. So the villagers eat the food that you've come in and spent tens of thousands of dollars to shoot and to hunt. And then it's a win-win, right? The economy benefits. They're clearing out animals that need to be culled. And of course, the community gets to eat a lot of the meat that ends up coming here. So this is also just seems like another woke policy. I don't understand where it's coming from, but I do think that, you know, it might enrich the German landscape to have some elephants
I'm just picturing, you know, some elephants like stomping through Berlin or something like that, and it's very satisfying.
One way to take down the Berlin Wall if you had 20,000 elephants roaming the streets.
Someone get on the AI image generator. Let's see how they've come up with that. That'd be hilarious.
Sure, I mean, not to nerd out too much, but when I was in grad school, I actually wrote a paper on this topic. It was about the devolution.
On shipping elephants to Germany from Botswana.
No, it was on the devolution of land rights in Namibia, which is another country in Southern Africa. And basically what they did was they took government land and they gave it to a private company who ran one of these big game farms in the hopes of conservation. So the idea was that when you have tourists coming in to hunt, there's an incentive for local people to make sure that the population sustain themselves. So since they brought in this program, the number of elephants and wildlife, endangered wildlife, has actually increased by 5 or 10%, because when it's completely wild, there's no one. It's a tragedy of the commons argument, a basic one. But it's kind of counterintuitive, because usually when you see, you know, people hunting, you think, oh, this is why these animals are endangered. But it's actually the way it works in practice is the opposite. That when you have the market involved, where there's incentives to keep these things alive, the populations grow because they do a better job doing that. And I think that's what's happening in Botswana. I think this is a case for argument for a lot of hunting. I mean, Andrew, you're much more involved in the hunting world than I am, but I believe that's why we are allowed to hunt animals like deer, because there's just too many of them, and they become a nuisance, and hunters are actually doing a service to farmers and to the broader country. And that's part of the argument that I don't think people who want to have these like knee-jerk reaction bans, that they just don't really understand it.
Yeah, no, exactly. And oftentimes, if we didn't have people who were doing this for recreational reasons, it would be some massive boondoggle government program that would have to be responsible for it.
Well, wasn't there a story of the feds paying a bunch of foreigners to go and shoot deer in British Columbia not too long ago? Did you not hear about that story where
I didn't.
The locals...
It feels like the setup to a movie.
No. It's real, and I'm gonna have Sean put this in the post roll so people know that I'm not just making it up.
Not a conspiracy theorist over there.
That locals in Canada were upset with the federal government because they paid tens of thousands of dollars to a group of foreigners to cull deer when the locals would have done it for free and they would have had the food for themselves. But again, the federal government does get in on this, and they botch it every single time.
Well, that's not surprising. I guess that's a good way to end the show. The federal government botches everything they ever try to do. So we'll leave it at that, gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks to the audience for tuning in. This has been Off the Record. And remember, everything you just heard is, in fact, off the record.
Yeah, we should do your idea, Harrison. Just do the True North Christmas party in Botswana.
Yeah, I think it will be good. You know, be an interesting story, at least. I'm sure our haters would dine off that for quite a while, though.
Yeah, we would.
Candace just driving around in a UTV with an LMG, just saying, "Yeah, come and get me."
Maybe we get an update in our Wikipedia page.
I want to get one of those safari helmets and a safari suit, and
you're going 1920s colonialist chic.
Yeah, I really embrace the whole trip.
That'll be great for your reputation, Harrison.
Yes, I think so.
You'll never get called a white supremacist again.
Yep, it'll put it all to rest.